an estimated 228,000 children and 11,000 mothers died.
The situation in South Asia is now even worse than that. This is Thursday, May 27th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. Also ahead, another call to cancel the Tokyo Olympics. Australia will close its embassy in Afghanistan, and Pakistan says no to U.S. bases. We examine the latest flashpoint of political incivility in America. Tariffs have been hard on a popular U.S. alcoholic beverage. Growing popularity of films for your computer. It is all on today's VOA Asia. The United Nations Children's Fund is calling for urgent action to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of children in South Asia who are missing out on routine life-saving vaccinations because of the COVID-19 pandemic. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
South Asia, home to nearly 2 billion people and more than a quarter of the world's children, is buckling under the strain of a deadly spike in coronavirus infections. The UN Children's Fund reports one person dies from COVID-19 every 17 seconds. It warns the sheer scale and speed of this new surge is outstripping the ability of countries to provide life-saving treatment. It says many fragile health systems are at the point of collapse. UNICEF Regional Director for South Asia, Georges Larrière-Agé, says everything must be done to prevent this from happening. Speaking on a video link from Kathmandu in Nepal, he says children and mothers depend upon these care facilities for survival.
During the first wave of COVID last year, an estimated 228,000 children and 11,000 mothers died because of disruptions to essential health services, like routine immunization, like care during childbirth, care during pregnancy, and so on.
He warns child and maternal deaths are likely to be much higher now because the present COVID-19 surge is four times the size of the first. Larrière-Agé says UNICEF has been on the ground working around the clock since the start of the pandemic, but he adds his agency is short of the supplies and the money it needs to carry out its life-saving operation.
UNICEF needs $164 million for urgent delivery of oxygen and testing supplies, for medical equipment, for PPEs, personal protective equipment, and infection prevention and control material.
The UNICEF official blames vaccine inequity for fueling the virus's rampage across the region. He says most high-risk populations remain unvaccinated, and unless the situation is rectified, the virus will continue to spread. He says the international community must not ignore this reality. He says wealthier countries that have excess vaccines should donate these doses to COVAX, the facility that provides vaccines to poorer countries. He warns the longer the virus is allowed to spread unchecked, the greater the risk that more deadly or contagious variants will emerge and circulate around the world. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Japan's Asahi Shinbun, an official partner of the Tokyo 2020 Olympics, is calling for the Summer Games to be canceled in an editorial on Wednesday, citing risks to public safety and strains on the medical system from the global health crisis. Brian Wood reports.
Japan's Asahi Daily, one of Japan's most prestigious newspapers, published a piece calling on Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga to, quote, calmly and objectively assess the situation and decide on the cancellation of the events this summer. They further cited the game's risk to public safety and potential strains on the medical system. The editorial was widely shared on Japanese social media and garnered more than 30,000 tweets by late Wednesday morning. Several polls have shown that the majority of Japanese people are opposed to holding the event, which draws in tens of thousands of athletes, officials, and spectators. Doctors' associations have already protested holding the games, along with some business investors. Other media sponsors have yet to chime in. Much of Japan, including host city Tokyo, remains under a third state of emergency that is widely expected to be extended beyond this month. Although Japan has been spared the ravages of overseas nations, it has struggled to control a fourth wave of infections. The U.S. earlier this week issued an advisory against travel to Japan, but still stood by the decision to hold the games as planned. Just over 5% of the population has received vaccinations.
That was Reuters' Brian Wood reporting. As of Wednesday, there are almost 17 million confirmed COVID-19 cases around the world, including 3.4 million deaths, according to Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Center. Read more about these developments by checking our website at voanews.com, as well as our many digital platforms. These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Malaysia sees daily record of coronavirus cases. Three crew members die when a Japanese fishing boat and a Russian cargo ship collide early Wednesday north of Japan's Hokkaido Island. China bars U.S. evangelical in response to sanctioning of Chinese official. WhatsApp files lawsuit in India over new laws that impact user privacy. A Malaysian transport operator had fired after response to a train crash. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia, Instagram, Twitter, and at the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. Australia says it will close its embassy in Afghanistan this week because it will not be able to guarantee security once international troops leave. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Australia's embassy in the Afghan capital of Kabul will shut on May 28. Prime Minister Scott Morrison said he hoped the closure would be temporary and that Australia could reopen an embassy in the future. Until then, diplomats will fly into Afghanistan from other countries. Morrison has said an increasingly uncertain security environment made it too unsafe for embassy staff to be based in Afghanistan. The precise location of the Australian embassy in Kabul has rarely been publicly identified due to security concerns. Mark Wales, a retired Australian Special Forces soldier, told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that closing the embassy is a logical move.
Kabul is still not a secure area. There's a lot of attacks happening there. So it makes sense that they would try and consolidate the embassy as US and allied troops are drawn down. It's a natural step towards concluding the war. I think the Taliban are in a position of significant leverage. They've outlasted a superpower and all the allies that we could muster.
There's been a surge in violence in recent weeks since President Biden announced the withdrawal of American troops, which will bring the NATO-led operation to an end. Some analysts have expressed concern that the military pullout could send Afghanistan back into a full-scale conflict. There are also concerns for Afghan nationals who worked with the Australians, particularly if peace talks between the Afghan government with the Taliban, a hardline Islamic movement, fail. A special investigator probing allegations of war crimes by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan said the closure of the embassy in Kabul was not ideal, but that contingencies to speak to witnesses were in place. Almost 40,000 Australians were deployed to Afghanistan during 20 years of war. 41 military personnel were killed. It's estimated that 60,000 members of the Afghan security forces died, and nearly twice as many civilians. About 80 Australian troops remain in the country, and they'll be brought home by September. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Meanwhile, the Taliban has warned the departing U.S. military leaving Afghanistan against setting up bases in the region, and Pakistan has vowed no American bases will be permitted on its territory. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
The statements come amid speculation. The U.S., as it withdraws the last of its 3,000-plus soldiers from Afghanistan, will want a nearby base from which to launch strikes against militant targets, as well as speaking out on bases. Pakistan says drone strikes from its territory were a non-starter. The developments, however, come during stepped-up efforts to jumpstart stalled peace talks between the government and the Taliban, possibly in Turkey. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
Happening now in Asia, Pakistan Wednesday opened up its coronavirus vaccination campaign to everyone age 19 or older as it scrambles to protect more of its 220 million people. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Thank you for being with us on VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman. A confrontation between two members of the U.S. Congress is the latest flashpoint of political incivility in America. VOA's Steve Reddish examines the issue.
The House will be in order.
Discord between America's two political parties grew dramatically after the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. It is personified by two members of Congress at the opposite ends of the political spectrum. Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene, elected to Congress in 2020 from the southern state of Georgia, and Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, elected in 2018 from the northern state of New York. While exiting the floor of the House of Representatives on May 12th, Taylor Greene reportedly confronted Ocasio-Cortez, challenging her to defend what Greene called her radical socialist beliefs. Ocasio-Cortez did not stop to answer. The Washington Post says she gestured in exasperation.
As though she had been posting some video. I mean, this is a woman that's deeply unwell and clearly needs some help.
So if we want to talk about assault, if we want to talk about aggressive behavior, you need to be interviewing the Democrats. And AOC should be able to debate her policy.
Debate on the floor of Congress is not as combative as in the British Parliament.
Did he make those remarks or remarks to that effect?
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker. And I think
Nor have fistfights broken out among members of Congress yet.
It's part of the DNA of democracy that there are going to be animosities, disagreements, hostilities, challenges that the other side's being uncivil and all the rest.
Robert Talese is a philosophy professor at Vanderbilt University and author of Overdoing Democracy. He says Americans' positions on government policies have been pretty much unchanged since the late 1980s.
What has intensified over the past 20, 25 years is interpartisan animosity. We dislike the other side more. We find people who vote in ways that don't match our own voting patterns more alien, more untrustworthy.
Instability shows that you don't respect your opponent, right? Which is something that is sort of saying this person isn't somebody that I see as my equal and somebody whose words I should listen to.
Mona Lena Crook teaches political science at Rutgers University and is the author of Violence Against Women in Politics. She says women in politics face a different level of incivility.
Public officials of different, you know, lots of different backgrounds face potential hostility from the public, from political opponents. But when women, you know, enter these spaces, they really seem to be facing sometimes that identity-based violence as well as that issue-based or issue-motivated violence.
As for the MJT versus AOC confrontation,
Marjorie Taylor Greene has specifically targeted AOC. She's also targeted other members of the so-called squad, right? So Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, Ayanna Pressley, were all women of color as well. And I think it's quite interesting that, you know, these aren't necessarily the most powerful, you know, figures in Congress, not the most powerful, you know, members of the Democratic Party.
But the sharp rhetoric does have a wider impact.
Winning the election has to do with getting people who are already on your side to behave as citizens, to vote, to give money, to canvass. to phone bank. And it turns out that animosity, resentment, indignation are really potent motivators for political behavior.
Representative Taylor Greene's confrontation with Representative Ocasio-Cortez is being referred to the House Ethics Committee. Steve Reddish, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA Asia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook. VOA Asia is also on Twitter and YouTube. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, read, and share all the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news, information, and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Taiwan directly accuses China for the first time on Wednesday of blocking a deal with Germany's BioNTech SE for COVID-19 vaccines in an escalating war of words after Beijing offered the shots to the island via a Chinese company. All of the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. We continue on VOA Asia. International exports of bourbon, an American whiskey mostly made in the southern state of Kentucky, have dropped dramatically as a result of the trade war that began during former President Donald Trump's administration. VOA's Kane Farabaugh has more.
James E. Pepper Bourbon is as old as America itself.
Originally founded during the American Revolution.
Its current owner, Amir Pei, says since 1780, this distinct brand of Kentucky bourbon passed the lips of many prominent Americans.
The favorite brand of Ulysses S. Grant, Andrew Jackson, Henry Clay, and many, many others.
Yet the distillery closed in the 1960s, after the Pepper family left the business and sales plunged. But with bourbon's continuing popularity, both at home and abroad, Pei saw an opportunity in relaunching the historic brand in 2008. Reopening in 2017 after spending millions of dollars renovating the distillery, Pei set his sights on increasing his market share internationally.
And while it only accounted for about 10% of our business at the time in 2017, we saw a lot of opportunity to expand. In fact, we thought we could grow it to 20% of our business in 2018-2019.
To do so, he created a 700 milliliter bottling line targeted for Europe, which the head of Kentucky's Distillers Association, Eric Gregory, says was a lucrative export market.
We were averaging between 20 and 30% growth every single year to the EU.
Then, out of the blue, says Pei, his dreams of expansion met the hard reality of global politics.
The United States put tariffs on steel and aluminum products from a number of countries, including the European Union, and the European Union decided to respond with tariffs on a number of American products,
including bourbon. Since 2018, it has been subject to a 25% tariff in Europe.
Crippling. This is something that we never saw coming.
Gregory says Kentucky bourbon sales dropped 35% globally, and it was about to get worse. EU tariffs were scheduled to double from 25 to 50% June 1st, but the hike is on pause while the Biden administration negotiates a broader trade agreement.
The problem we face right now is all the whiskey imports coming into the United States are tariff-free for the next 4 months. Meanwhile, we're facing still 25% on our exports.
The industry's goal is to get back to zero tariffs.
For us, it's just getting back to free and fair trade. We just want people to sit down at a table and work this problem out.
Until then, Amir Pei is trying to deal with the uncertainty created by the trade war so he can plan for the long term.
Because you don't want to send over product, and this is especially true for a small business like mine, that sits in a warehouse and doesn't sell, because that's a lot of money that we've tied up in producing that whiskey. And there's no guarantee it's going to sell. Then how do we get it back over here in the United States? We can't sell it over here, so it's very risky to do that.
An end to the dispute with the EU over steel tariffs that led to the bourbon tariffs isn't a sure thing. Steel groups in the United States support the tariffs, which have generated capacity investment. Trade cooperation is a topic on the agenda during President Biden's first foreign trip when he attends a U.S.-EU summit in Brussels in June. Kane Farabaugh, VOA News, Lexington, Kentucky.
Making headlines in Asia, China's tech hub of Shenzhen aims to make it more difficult for people from out of town to settle in a rare tightening of residency rules as its population balloons and resources and services come under pressure. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, strong winds and rainfall lashed India's eastern coast Wednesday morning ahead of the landfall of Cyclone Yaas. Maha Abhadroi reports.
More than a million people have been evacuated and tens of thousands of mud houses have been destroyed in eastern India as the second powerful cyclone in a week brought storm surges to coastal areas. Cyclone Yaas was packing gusts of up to 87 miles per hour as it hit land, authorities said. Days after Tuktai tore up the western coast, piling pressure on authorities already battling the country's intense coronavirus disaster. The state of West Bengal says about 20,000 mud houses and temporary shelters in the state have been damaged or leveled. Cyclones in the Bay of Bengal are common at this time of year, and often roar ashore, bringing death and destruction to the coastal areas of both India and neighboring Bangladesh.
Reuters' Maha Abhadroi. Profile, a film by Timur Bekmambetov about an investigative journalist infiltrating recruitment practices online by the Islamic State group, also known as ISIS, is the latest in a series of screen-life films where everything the viewer sees happens on a computer or a smartphone screen. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with the filmmaker and the cast.
Profile, a thriller by Timur Bekmambetov, plays out entirely on the protagonist's computer screen. Bekmambetov tells VOA he has created a new format of visual content he calls Screen Life. Screen Life films have been gaining traction during the pandemic.
Assalamu alaikum, my sister.
It's how we live now because we spend 90% of our time we spend in digital world.
Bekmambetov says his Screen Life films are immersive, allowing the viewer to click on the protagonist's computer screen, open her links and files, and delve deeper into her investigation or the background of the story.
For example, now you see me on screen, but you cannot grab my cigarettes. But in Screen Life, you can, because you can interact with the reality of the character.
The film can also be viewed in the traditional format, a theater screen. Based on a true story, Profile follows the young journalist as she undergoes Islamic State recruitment through online contact with Abu Bilal, a London-born militant.
I think it's so interesting to be able to see the interior life of the actors told through the way they text message and the way they write emails and the way they delete things and don't say things.
With every Skype call, an exchange of messages with Bilal, she risks having her true identity revealed. She's also falling for the terrorist and seems to consider joining him in Syria.
They're both outsiders. They're both Londoners who don't quite feel like life has ended up where they wanted it to.
What about you?
Shahzad Latif, a British actor of Pakistani descent, plays the IS recruiter. He told VOA that at first he was reluctant to embody a terrorist, fearing he could be stereotyped in this type of role. He agreed to it because fundamentally, he says, it was a love story.
I love you!
I could see all their Skype conversations. It was verbatim.
As for him being able to emote through the computer,
the last 10 years or whatever, people are more public, you know, more with their private feelings to a computer screen than they are to the people they know, especially young people, you know.
Screen Life films can be produced in a little over a week on a computer screen and are cost-effective. Searching, Bekmambetov's 2018 Screen Life thriller, about a father frantically searching for online clues in his daughter's disappearance, cost $1 million to make and grossed $75 million.
Screen Life doesn't cost a lot of money, and it's like a writing book. You need a pen and paper, and you can do whatever you want.
Like immersing us into the world of Islamic State recruitment. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
Amy, what's going on?
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. and find us on Instagram and YouTube and at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our service chief, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Jim Stevenson, Amy Heibels, Keith Lane, and Doug Bernard. I'm Ira Melman. Stay safe and enjoy the day.